Today is Monday, January 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. The UN Security Council meets to discuss Russia's military buildup along Ukraine at the request of the U.S. ambassador to the UN.
The Security Council is unified. Our voices are unified in calling for the Russians to explain themselves.
North Korea tests another ballistic missile. Some analysts say it's no big deal.
Right now, no one is really commenting on the test other than those who follow Korean Peninsula issues.
And a look at Myanmar 1 year after the military coup. We'll have these stories and more next. The United Nations Security Council is meeting Monday for the first time to discuss Russia's buildup of more than 100,000 troops along Ukraine's border at the request of the U.S. Western and Ukrainian officials continue to be on alert for a possible invasion, as we hear from VOA's Arash Arabasadi.
52-year-old Mariana Zaglo is a mother of three. She works in marketing and lives in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. Zaglo is also a territorial defense reservist willing to fight for her country should Russian soldiers amassed on the border invade.
I'm a soldier now, and of course I must follow orders. Whatever the order is, I will follow it. I will not kill people, but I will protect my home.
According to the Reuters news agency, Kyiv wants to build this reservist force to 130,000 people. Meanwhile, the United States continues sending weapons and ammunition to Ukraine following President Joe Biden's announcement of a small troop deployment to Eastern Europe. The U.S. plans to confront Russia over its actions along Ukraine's border at a Monday meeting of the United Nations Security Council.
The Security Council is unified. Our voices are unified in calling for the Russians to explain themselves. We're going to go in the room prepared to listen to them, but we're not going to be distracted by their propaganda, and we're going to be prepared to respond to any disinformation that they attempt to spread during this meeting.
Ambassador Thomas Greenfield added that a Russian attack on Ukraine is possible, saying, quote, "You don't amass 100,000 troops if you don't have intentions to use them." At a recent news conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the Kremlin wants mutually respectful relations with the U.S., but added what he called NATO's encroachment farther east as cause for Russian concern. In Washington, Ukraine's border has become a rare moment of political unity amid growing calls to bolster the former Soviet republic.
America always stands for freedom. You know, we are the country that believes that people's free will ought to be respected, that sovereignty matters, that the dignity of the Ukrainian people matters, and this is what they want. So their territorial integrity is at risk right now, and it is appropriate that the free world stand by them.
Meanwhile, arms continue flowing to Ukraine like British-supplied anti-tank missiles.
We do not want to be part of the Soviet Union or the Russian Empire or the Russian Federation. We want to be sovereign, we are sovereign, and we are fighting for our independence. And if Ukraine will be further attacked by Russia, of course they will not stop after Ukraine. So that's why it's in the interest of Europe and all democratic world to help us to defend ourselves, but also to show that the international rule of law still works.
NATO countries continue sending material support while the NATO chief has ruled out sending troops into Ukraine in case of an invasion. The West has ruled out Russia's demand that NATO promise never to allow Ukraine to join the alliance. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Two leading U.S. senators say the Senate is very close to reaching a deal on legislation to sanction Russia over its actions regarding Ukraine, including some measures that may take effect before any invasion. Tamara Lindstrom of Reuters has this report.
U.S. senators are very close to reaching a deal on legislation to sanction Russia over its actions regarding Ukraine, including some measures that may take effect before any invasion, two leading senators said on Sunday. Senators Bob Menendez, the Democratic chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and James Risch, the committee's top Republican, said they hope to move forward on the bill this week. Menendez added that there is strong bipartisan resolve to support Ukraine and punish Russia if it invades. Russia has been building up its forces on Ukraine's borders for months and has demanded NATO pull troops and weapons from Eastern Europe and bar Ukraine from ever joining the U.S.-led military alliance. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky supports immediate action and has criticized the West for waiting to impose more damaging sanctions. The U.S. Senate bill would target the most significant Russian banks and Russian sovereign debt, as well as provide more U.S. military assistance to Ukraine. Menendez said that some of the sanctions could take effect before any invasion by Russia because of what Moscow has already done, including cyber attacks on Ukraine and efforts to undermine the Ukrainian government internally. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Sunday tweeted that the situation is increasingly concerning and urged Russia to engage in negotiations. Johnson said he has ordered British armed forces to prepare to deploy across Europe next week to support NATO allies. The prime minister is also due to visit the region this week and will speak by phone to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
That was Tamara Lindstrom with Reuters. U.S. President Joe Biden will host the leader of Qatar at the White House this afternoon, discussing the potential for an energy crunch. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The Middle Eastern nation of Qatar, friendly to the U.S., is one of the world's largest natural gas suppliers. President Biden's hosting its ruling leader, seeking a backup plan for fuel if Russia invades Ukraine and triggers an energy crunch in Europe. An energy expert at the Middle East Institute in Washington says even though Qatar is willing to help the U.S., it's going to be limited because there isn't excess supply of liquefied natural gas. Qatar's already producing at full capacity, with much of its supply under contract to Asia. I'm Jackie Quinn.
North Korea has confirmed its test of an intermediate-range ballistic missile. It is the biggest missile North Korea has tested in more than 4 years. The move further increases pressure on the administration of U.S. President Biden, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
North Korea says it tested the Hwasong-12 intermediate-range ballistic missile. It was last launched in 2017, seen here. This time, North Korea also released two photos taken after the warhead reached outer space. North Korea says the missile was launched at a steep angle to avoid flying over other countries. But Japanese government spokesperson Hirokazu Matsuno condemned the launch.
Such intense ballistic missile launches are in violation of relevant Security Council resolutions. And our country has made a strong protest to North Korea through the embassy route in Beijing.
South Korea also held an emergency meeting of its National Security Council and called for the North to return to talks. North Korea has launched 11 missiles in January, setting a new monthly record. Though the latest test is its biggest in 4 years, analysts such as Ramon Pacheco Pardo say it may not be seen as a major provocation.
If North Korea really wanted to catch everyone's attention, they would go down the ICBM or nuclear test, and they haven't done it. Right now, no one is really commenting on the test other than those who follow Korean Peninsula issues.
In response to the latest launch, a senior U.S. official told reporters he expects North Korea to soon conduct bigger tests to extract concessions from the United States. He said the U.S. is open to negotiations, but doesn't want a presidential summit for the moment. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
1 year after the military coup in Myanmar, the army remains in power and democratically elected leaders face lengthy prison sentences as people continue to resist the seizure of power. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir has more.
Myanmar has been mired in chaos and violence since the military rejected the November 2020 election results and overthrew the civilian government on February 1st of last year. Rights groups say some 1,500 civilians, including dozens of children, have been killed and thousands more arrested in the military crackdown on protesters. It has not, however, lessened the people's resolve to demand a return to democracy. Tom Andrews is the UN Special Rapporteur on Myanmar.
I'm in awe of the people of Myanmar, and I'm certain that, or as certain as I can be, that this has surprised Min Aung Hlaing and the military junta, who I think thought that they could get away with this, and they're finding that they just were not bargaining for the level of commitment of the people of Myanmar to saving their country.
The military has arrested, tried, and sentenced de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, President Yoon Min, and other high-ranking officials from the National League for Democracy Party. Military Chief General Min Aung Hlaing went to Indonesia in April for a summit of regional bloc ASEAN, where he agreed to implement a 5-point plan that included ending the violence and starting a national dialogue. It's a pledge he has not kept. At the UN Security Council, there has been a lack of action. Veto holders, China and Russia, do not want to see sanctions or an arms embargo on Myanmar's military. And a fear by other members of worsening existing council divisions has blocked meaningful action. Louis Charbonneau is the UN director for Human Rights Watch.
It's frankly, what the Myanmar military has gotten from the Security Council is a green light. They know that they will get away with murder because countries aren't even going to try. They've given up.
With no council action, on June 18th, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution essentially urging an arms embargo. But their resolutions are not legally binding. Richard Gowan is the UN director for the International Crisis Group.
Well, I think that international institutions, including the UN and ASEAN, are stuck. And there is no obvious pathway for the Security Council or any other international body to put enough pressure on the military to reverse the coup.
Without an international arms embargo or targeted economic sanctions to pressure the generals, Myanmar's people have begun to fight back. Xin Mar Aung is the foreign minister for Myanmar's opposition National Unity Government.
People are resisting to eliminate the military dictatorship by every possible means. Armed struggle is just one of the many ways to resist.
Violence has grown elsewhere across Myanmar between the military and ethnic armed groups, displacing hundreds of thousands of people. Tom Andrews, UN Special Rapporteur on Myanmar.
The junta has declared war on the people of Myanmar, and they're identifying those who live in Myanmar, in these villages, as the enemy, and so therefore they feel that they have license to attack them, to kill them, to torture them. So the extent of the human rights violations, the degree of the human rights violations, is just horrific, and I'm afraid it's not getting better. It's getting worse.
Analysts say the prospect for quick resolution of the crisis is unlikely. International Crisis Group's Richard Gowan.
I think that for the time being, we sadly feel that we're going to see violence rumble on, and that even if it's contained, the chances of a political settlement are low.
Margaret Bashir, VOA News.
11 years ago, the spark of the Arab Spring was ignited in Tunisia. Within months, crowds massed in Cairo's Tahrir Square to demand the ouster of Egypt's strongman, President Hosni Mubarak. And there were mass uprisings in Libya, Syria, and Yemen to follow. But instead of a transition to democracy, autocratic rule has become entrenched in the Middle East. Reporter Angie Omar discussed the reasons behind retreat from democracy in the region with Sarah Lee Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now.
The retreat of human rights and democracy in the Middle East is not an accident, nor is it a sociological circumstance that we need to find answers for, but rather the very deliberate outcome of a political campaign, an orchestrated political campaign by the forces of autocracy in the Middle East that encouraged coups in places where a democratic government had taken hold, like in Egypt, and have done everything to undermine democracy in the Arab world because it's an existential threat to them. The Saudi monarchy, the Emirates of the UAE, the military in Egypt, they don't want democracy in the Middle East because it would mean the end of their power. And that is why they have worked very hard to fight against the democratic upheavals of 2011. But the good news is that the aspirations of the Arab people for democracy, for human rights, for justice, it persists. And that's why we've seen uprisings continue in Iraq, in Algeria, in Sudan. And even now, we see Tunisians emerging to resist the coup that's underway in their country. The good news is you can't really crush the aspiration for freedom and democracy in any human being. People will always rise up once they are able to reassemble their spirits and their strength.
Pro-democracy activists in the Arab Spring countries cite different reasons for their failure. Inconsistent support from the West, intervention by other powers, and the inability of protesters to transition to politics. What is your take on that?
Well, I would say that the notion that the protesters could not transition to politics is patently false. If we look at the example of Egypt, for example, or Tunisia, for example, what the Egyptian people achieved in peacefully overthrowing a 30-year dictatorship is really something that stands in world history as a tremendous achievement, that they were able to then hold the first fair and free elections in the history of Egypt is a tremendous achievement. That was the success of politics. That was the success of the Egyptian people, not a failure. The fact that the people of Egypt, just like the people of Tunisia, could not withstand the forces of tyranny, the militaries that have turned against them, the militaries that have been supported by extremely wealthy and powerful governments like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and correctly, with virtually no support from the West, from the United States, from the so-called champions of democracy. Those are the reasons why these uprisings have failed and have been overtaken by the forces of tyranny. I think that certainly there was a major weakness in the failure of democratic activists in each of these countries to come together to form a transnational movement, just the way that the forces of autocracy have formed a transnational movement to resist democracy.
That was Sarah Lee Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World, speaking with journalist Angie Omar from New York City. You're listening to VOA News.
Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa. We'll look at the future of finding work in Africa, with a generation of young people more educated and more unemployed than ever. What and where are the jobs of the future? To find out, join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Damme. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Monday received an update on the internal inquiry into parties at his Downing Street residence that allegedly breached coronavirus lockdown restrictions. The inquiry into parties held in Johnson's Downing Street complex said some of the events should not have been allowed and identified leadership lapses. Johnson is facing a grave threat to his leadership over the alleged lockdown-busting parties. Police in Macau, an autonomous region of China, arrested the head of the territory's second-largest junket group as authorities tightened the grip on the gambling hub's multi-billion-dollar industry. Police arrested and detained Chan Wenling, the founder of Tak Chun Group, which is involved in bringing gamblers from mainland China to Macau's casinos. Macau is the only place in China where gambling is legal. The Cyprus Supreme Court on Monday overturned the conviction of a young British woman who had been found guilty of lying about being gang-raped by 12 Israeli tourists. Defense lawyers successfully argued there had been a miscarriage of justice when a district court in January of 2020 found her guilty of public mischief and gave her a suspended 4-month jail term. The woman, who is now 21 years old, had told police in July 2019 that she was raped by Israeli tourists aged 15 to 22 in a hotel room in the Mediterranean Islands resort town of Ayia Napa. In Beijing, athletes from 17 countries and regions have begun training at the National Speed Skating Oval. They're warming up for 2022 Winter Olympic Games, which get underway on Friday. 166 international athletes will compete at China National Speed Skating Oval, known as the Ice Ribbon. The Australian Air Force is preparing to deliver 20 tons of emergency supplies to remote communities cut off by floodwaters. Traffic has been disrupted on the main highway and railway between Adelaide in South Australia and Darwin, the capital city of the Northern Territory. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Heavy rain and storms in recent days have damaged freight routes in South Australia. A 14-day major emergency was declared Friday by state authorities. It gives the police special powers to ensure food reaches isolated communities. South Australia has a population of 1.7 million who are already under a major emergency declaration for COVID-19. The state was also badly impacted by the Black Summer bushfires of 2019-20, although the floods have occurred away from the areas worst hit by the fires. The area is expected to receive yet more rain, with up to 200 millimetres forecast in the coming days. A military plane is scheduled to land Monday in the outback settlement of Kuba Pedi to deliver food and other essentials. The town is 850 kilometres north of Adelaide on the Stuart Highway and is known as the opal capital of the world because of its mining resources. The impact on mining and farming might not be known for days. Tim Jackson, the administrator of the Kuba Pedi Council, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the arrival of supplies would ease community concerns.
They were pretty relaxed, generally speaking, I think, and particularly now that they know that there's a significant food drop being made today. It's just a bit frustrating. It's just the unknown about when the highway's going to be opened again. I understand that it's the first time both the rail and the road have been impacted simultaneously.
Flooding in South Australia and the disruption to freight routes have led to shortages on supermarket shelves in the Northern Territory and Western Australia. Higher than average rainfall this summer is associated with a La Niña weather system, which can also produce a higher than normal number of tropical cyclones. The naturally occurring system develops when strong winds move the warm surface waters of the Pacific Ocean from South America towards Indonesia. In Australia, the La Niña system increases the likelihood of cooler daytime temperatures, reducing the risk of bushfires and heat waves. Conservationists are warning that the impact of climate change will increase the incidence and intensity of extreme rainfall events in Australia. They've said that the risks of flooding are exacerbated when the atmosphere is made warmer and wetter by climate change. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Spotify will add a content advisory to any podcast episode that includes discussion about COVID-19, according to Chief Executive Officer Daniel Ek. He made the announcement after coming under fire from rock and folk legends such as Neil Young and Joni Mitchell for giving voice to misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines. Reuters correspondent Jason Albano reports.
Audio streaming giant Spotify is tightening its policing of COVID-related podcasts. CEO Daniel Ek said on Sunday that Spotify will soon add a content advisory to podcast episodes that discuss COVID-19. That comes as high-profile artists, from rock and folk legends Neil Young and Joni Mitchell to best-selling author Brené Brown, have been pulling their work from a service that they said has also allowed misinformation on vaccines to air. Young, in particular, objected to his music being played on the same platform as prominent vaccine skeptic Joe Rogan's top-rated podcast, The Joe Rogan Experience. In a letter a few weeks ago, hundreds of scientists and medical professionals urged Spotify to take action against Rogan, accusing him of spreading falsehoods on the podcast. Spotify's new advisory will direct listeners to a hub containing facts and information on COVID-19 from medical and health experts, as well as links to trusted sources. CEO Ek also said Spotify will be publishing platform rules for its creators. In a post, he wrote, quote, "It is important to me that we don't take on the position of being content censor, while also making sure that there are rules in place and consequences for those that violate them."
That was Reuters correspondent Jason Albano. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of managing editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.